boat had happened to me, or so it seemed to me then. I came from a stable, middle-class family. There were no bizarre illnesses. My parents were childhood sweethearts. They were married for 66 years. Oh man, I might have said if I could have verbalized it then, how could you have done this to me? No material. Don't you understand I'm trying to be a writer here? As a result of this lack of juicy material in my own childhood and adolescence, for which I entirely blame my parents, and for those of you who are striving or who have striven to provide your children with a secure, loving childhood, beware. You never know what is going to be thrown back in your face, what is going to bite you on the proverbial parental bottom. But then again, you probably don't want your children to grow up to be neurotic, impoverished artists anyway. That you're saving for yourselves, no doubt. In any case, I was forced to make things up or to create art from other people's lives. I was unprepared, as it were, to transform my own life into art because I didn't think at that time that there was anything worth transforming. Instead, I learned to form psychic connections with my characters, who were often based on or inspired by people that I knew, people who had had something happen to them. I think it's fair to say that in my first three published novels, very little of the life that was being transformed into art was my life. Instead, I'd imagine myself into the lives of my characters, or imagine being those characters. And to do so, I would sometimes actually do some of the things, that is, live some of the life of my characters and the real-life inspiration for those characters. Thus, in my first novel, which was inspired by a guy I'd known in college who'd taken too much acid and run naked across the Brooklyn Bridge one night and gotten arrested, I ran across the Brooklyn Bridge, clothed. I told you I was sort of boring back then, imagining what doing it naked would have felt like. And when I decided that this character, Humphrey Stern, would go to look for the grandfather he never knew he had on a farm in western Kansas, which in my novel had inspired him to make this big leap and break from his past, I actually went to a farm in western Kansas to do that, drawing on a friend who was from the Midwest, and that novel was really about moving out from the East to the rest of the country. In my second novel, in which the setup is what if a protest singer-songwriter like Phil Oakes, for whom music was political and who killed himself in 1974, had a younger sister with a pop voice who, galvanized by her famous brother's suicide, which in the published novel became his attempted suicide, I again researched the novel by living in New York City, hanging out in music bars, traveling with and hanging out backstage with bands I talked my way into, so that I could transform researched life into art. I'd also, as you may have picked up on by now, had worked some as a journalist. And so the idea that you learned about lives by actually learning about them was part of the method by which I worked. This method, which was all compensation for how hard done by I was by my parents, left me ill-prepared to transform my own life into art once I began to have enough of a life to do it to. The one time I tried early on in my career was pretty early on. In fact, an event that took place just as I was deciding to become a writer. Right after college, during which I'd been working on a novel which not only didn't come out of my own life, but which featured a protagonist I didn't really psychically connect with. I started Columbia Law School, kept working to revise that early novel, which fortunately was never published. Then I dropped out of Columbia Law School, sold clothing at a now defunct department store, and by now it was early January in New York. I was still living in the Columbia area, and I was just about to move up to where I'd gone to college to finish writing and produce a rock musical I'd written with my college songwriting partner. So it's January, we're on 105th Street near Broadway in Manhattan, and it's the 70s, a time in which race relations are a little bit tense in New York City, and I'm a New York City kid, I've grown up there. And I am literally getting into my large, beat-up Catalina to drive to the friend's apartment to pick him up, to move him into the apartment that I'm vacating, to go off, having thrown a secure path behind me, to work on this rock musical. So I come down to my car, and an African-American couple greets me, a man and a woman, greets me near the car and asks if they can get a ride from me. No one hitchhikes in New York City. No one asks total strangers for a car ride anywhere. And I know all this. I have ridden the subway to high school during my entire youth. I'm a pretty savvy New York City kid. But because I'm leaving literally the next day, this is it, I say, sure. And I get into the front seat of the car. The couple, the woman sits next to me. This is a Catalina. It's a really pretty big car. She sits next to me. He sits next to the passenger door. And we set out. I'm going down. If any of you know New York City geography, it's 105th and Broadway. I'm headed somewhere into the mid-70s between Columbus and Amsterdam to pick up my friend. Meanwhile, I know what's going to happen. Or at least I think I know what's going to happen. At a certain point, they're going to stick me up. They're actually very nice people. And the woman in the middle starts by saying, well, you know, my grandma's apartment burned down, and we have to go down and see her, and that's why we need the ride, and thank you very much. And I, you know, this is clearly a very bad story, one that I don't believe. And then she falls silent. The guy at the door starts to talk about the layoffs that had occurred in New York City, you know, within the previous couple of years and how he's been laid off. And I can tell he's well-spoken, sounds as if he's educated, sounds a little desperate. I've always been a guilty liberal. I'm feeling bad about him. But nonetheless, I can see where this story is going. And so I say, well, you know, I'm out of work too. And so we're silent a little longer. And then he says, well, where are you going? And I say, I'm helping a friend to move. And he says, gosh, I really wish I could have a job helping somebody move. And I say, I'm not getting paid. I'm just helping him. By this point, you were driving down Broadway. We've cleared the 90s. We're in the 80s. And he says, would you mind getting off Broadway? I assume he doesn't want to stick me up on a big crowded street with lots of traffic going by. I wouldn't either. So I say, okay. And so now I have gone all the way two blocks further west. so that I can make the left turn the side street where my friend is waiting with all his things, I might add, which is a good thing I have this giant rusty Catalina, goes west to east. And we pull up, you know, in front of, it's a fairly narrow side street, and I'm maybe 10 or 15 feet past where my friend is waiting because there was no place to stop right in front of the building, but I'm still too close to the center of the street so that cars can't get by. And he says, would you mind pulling a little closer to the parked cars? Because he doesn't want traffic lining up behind us while he's sticking me up. And I'm thinking by this point already, all right, already, let's get on with it. And it's all in a certain way because, you know, this magical thing is happening in my life. I'm really throwing caution to me. I'm going off to be a writer this day. And so I move a little closer to the parked car and then pulls a gun out of his pocket. Finally, I'm thinking. And I'm saying, okay, you know, I'm going to get my wallet out of my pocket, you know, but I got to tell you, you know, I only have $4. And he looks even more embarrassed and upset than he has during much of this event, grabs her by the arm, jumps out of the car, and they run off. And this has all happened exactly as I can remember. It's been many years now. So a year later, I'm in the Stanford Writing Workshop, and I'm dining out on this story. It's such a great story, right? You know, it could not end. And I try to turn it into a short story, and I can't. You know, it seems it's like so perfect in the way that it happened, so kind of fraught with meaning and event. There's this dramatic event. I know where it's going. He doesn't, you know, that try as I might, I couldn't change or transform it. And what I couldn't really change or transform was what the story meant. And so the actual event lay there on the page like a bad smell in a room with no windows. It's kind of dead without life in it. It lay there, in fact, and this is what I think we all need to think about as we're trying to transform life into art. It lay there like something that had already happened, not something that was going to happen and that was going to burst into life on the page, but like something that had already happened and all the life had been sucked out of it. Years later, perhaps now, I would understand that in trying to write it, I hadn't lied enough. I hadn't embellished. I hadn't made enough things up. So one of my pieces of advice is, of course, to lie. You are not a reporter. There's no crying in baseball. And you are here to lie and make things up. Nonetheless, this failed attempt to transform my own life into art made me feel inadequate, because by then I'd come upon the famous quote by Flannery O'Connor. Anybody who has survived his childhood has enough information about life to last him the rest of his days. And I took that to mean, and I think it's probably true, that just because nothing has happened to you directly worth writing about doesn't mean you have nothing to write about or that you need to feel inadequate because you've endured a happy childhood. And I'd also learned, despite being advised as a young writer by more than one wise old editor to write about what I knew about, that Saul Bellow had written Henderson the Rain King, an episodic novel about traveling all around Africa before he'd set foot on the continent, that it was possible to imagine things and have them feel like life. So it was clear to me that to write only about what you knew, I didn't know that much. And so my third novel was about a Jewish pitcher for an unnamed National League team that played in Queens, who'd been banned from baseball. And so I had failed again, really, it seemed to me, to transform my own life into art, because although I'm Jewish, and Jewish Joe's singer backstory was based on a cousin of mine, and I know an awful lot about baseball and the Mets, it was still a work of imagination, not life transformed, or at least not my life transformed. And then, suddenly, I was no longer in my 20s or even in my 30s, and things began to happen in my life that seemed to be worth writing about. So my second piece of advice about transforming life into art is to live a little. Above all, don't die. And let time go by. For life to be transformed into art, it really needs to settle down a little bit. There's a reason that people, I think, in their early 20s, rarely write great memoirs, or great novels for that matter. And it's not because nothing dramatic or worth writing about has happened in their lives yet. It's because the alchemy that transforms life into art takes time. Like wine or cheese, you're not translating life into art. You're not blogging life into art. You're transforming it. And that, as I said, takes some time, some psychic difference, distance, I mean to say, and maybe even a little wisdom. And so I'd like to give or begin talking about one more example from my own life and writing of what this means and how it seems to work, at least to me, now that I actually am drawing on my own life. Perhaps two. My last published novel was really inspired by being the understanding but somewhat troubled father of a gay son in a conservative small town. And I found myself writing that novel, much to my great surprise, in the midst of another because of things that had happened in our lives. I was at an artist colony there to work on one book. There'd been some trauma in our lives at home, predictably enough, with the football team. And that book kind of popped into my head, and I set the other one aside, and began to work on that novel. The characters in it were transformed, but the gay teenage son was very clearly my own son. And in that novel, for the first time, as I did readings, and I read a great deal from that novel, both where I lived, and the town was recognizable as Oxford, Ohio, where I live and teach, there were often questions did that really happen? A disturbing question, because I think you'll find, if you work from your own life, that once you have written it and transformed it, that is what happened. And it gets hard to remember what really happened and what's happened on the page. And so that's one mark of what it is you're trying to do, that if you are working from life, it really needs to be transformed so powerfully on the page that it takes over that reality. And how you forget what happened into writing what's happening to your fictional characters, well, that sort of requires, again, I think, both believing in those characters in the strongest of ways and in sort of what I can only call a willingness to forget that the fictional supplants the actual in some way that makes the fictional version of events, and you need to be willing to let go of the actual event in some way that it doesn't matter what actually happened. It only matters if it works on the page. And for people who are first beginning this process, writers young in experience, to say when your work is being critiqued by others, oh, that's what really happened. That is a self-defense that is without value of any sort whatsoever. Once you have taken life and transformed it into art, whether you are writing memoir or fiction, it needs to stand on its own as the made object. And so if it doesn't work on the page, then it doesn't work. It doesn't matter if it happened that way. All that matters is what you've made of it. And so there is a certain danger in using your life or the life of those you love for art, because A, it's going to be out there to be read by others who may ask you that question, you know, did that really happen? And B, there's a certain way in which you are cannibalizing your own life. You are taking it, mining it, using it as the raw material for something that should come out different. If it doesn't, it's going to lie there, like my experience with the person in that car, a dead thing. That's not what you want. You want it to be, and I'll come back to channeling my inner Flannery O'Connor at the end of this talk, you want it to be discovered as it's happening on the page. You need to discover your own material, even if in fact it is coming out of life. Now, I'd like to talk just briefly about what I'm working on now and even read you a little bit from it and give you an idea of how I understand we mine our own lives and how they get stitched together in sort of surprising ways. And that, so it's that it's not a one-to-one correspondence between what you're writing, but more of an emulsification process. So what I'm going to talk about right now and read from briefly is something I'm working on now or perhaps have just finished, depending on whether or not it's going to become a novel or will remain a long, short story. It draws on three significant events from my own life. My father died 3.5 years ago. Almost 5 years ago, my 12-year-old golden retriever was diagnosed with an incurable cancer. And 12 years ago, on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, I was knocked out of a tree holding a running chainsaw by a large limb that seemed to disobey every known law of nature. Three distinct and disparate events from my own life transformed into a single work of what I hope is art. I had, particularly the event of being in that tree and being knocked out, I had always thought that I would write about in some way, because it was dramatic, not in the way that it came to be used in this story. I won't read that section because it's at the end, but having let these three disparate events settle in my mind, I think there's probably like the two-year rule. If something's happened to you less than 2 years before, then it's going to be hard to let go of what actually happened to write about what is going to have the full power of invention on the page. Okay, so here we are a little bit. In June, Peter's dead father fevered his dreams. By August, he was seeing the old boy on the street. walking Seaver, his golden retriever, towards the only unbuilt lot in the housing development, Peter would glimpse Herb Morris, 3 years gone and not in the best of health or soundness of mind when he departed, peering out from behind a curtain of honeysuckle, wearing what appeared to be Bermuda shorts and the terry cloth robe Peter had bought him for his 75th birthday. What could it mean? Herb had died in Florida, but was interred in a Long Island plot where there was space reserved for the next generation, including Peter and his estranged wife, Cheryl. Alive, Herb had disdained trees, leaves, grass, most things green. Insects, small and large, dismayed him. So why was he hiding in the trees? His death had been attended by all three sons after a long and happy life. Certainly a life far happier than the one Peter now enjoyed. Happier, for that matter, than any Peter knew of, except for Seaver, who'd reached the dogly plateau of 12 in perfect health and contentment, except for recent problems peeing. So what was Herb doing in Ohio, wearing a green robe from Macy's over what looked like check shorts, or were those swimming trunks cinched high around his shrunken waist? Peter, who'd had trouble getting out of bed since Cheryl left, didn't want to know. Seaver, who'd liked the old potzer, didn't wag his tail when they passed the apparition, so maybe there was nothing there. Then what was Peter seeing? He didn't believe in ghosts. He barely believed in God, and only because he couldn't work up the conviction not to. After all the crap he'd faced down in the past 9 months, the layoffs at the university, the decimation of his 403B, and his wife of 24 years dumping him for a dentist named Bernstein, he believed in nothing more profound than holding on to his own spreading bottom with both hands. He also believed in not being observed conversing with tree trunks. But on this warm September Thursday, home late after his seminar, head empty as his bed after Cheryl abandoned it, Peter turned right out of his cul-de-sac, Seaver, named after his favorite pitcher, shuffling at his side, and came upon his father in plain view. Just as the white-faced golden retriever lifted his leg without much effect at the pole supporting a stop sign, his father's ghost, or what appeared to be the ghost of Herb Morris, asked, "How long you gonna ignore me, Pete? People will think I didn't raise you good." Peter glanced around. "What are you doing here?" "Fucked if I know," the old man said. "One minute I'm playing rummy with the other Altacacas, the next I'm not." He stroked his head, which for 40 years had been bushed with a gray toupee, but which now gleamed like freckled granite. "What do you think? I got rid of the rug. Better?" "Much." "All those years you couldn't say something?" In her goodbye note, a litany of bitter complaint, Cheryl had listed, "Your unbearable silence, number one." Herb added, "That's one of the things we got to work on." Seaver, lifting his leg at the neighbor's mailbox, looked back, brown eyes pleading, "Can we go to the lot? Can we go to the lot? Can we go to the lot?" "What do you mean, we, Dad?" Herb said, "You're doing so good by yourself." Seaver squeezed out a few drops and lowered his leg. "Dad," Peter said, "you're dead." "I am not," the old boy answered. "I'm in Ohio, same as you." Much happens in the story, and it ends up in that tree with the running chainsaw and the avenging log of God, perhaps. But my point about it is that three events spread across my life came together in this, so that it's, as I say, I'm not translating life into art. I'm transforming it from multiple sources. And that's one thing I think that you ought to think about. I think you also ought to think about the wonderful line from Flannery O'Connor, "I write to discover what I know." If you're transforming art, life into art, you know your materials, at least you think you do. But you're discovering them as you're using them in your writing. If you know the meaning of what has happened, it's not going to work very well, at least it doesn't seem to me. And so if that's what you're trying to do, just get down exactly what happened without discovering anything while you're doing it, I think that you're headed for a hard time. Lie is one way to help yourself there. Embellish, change details. There are some simple guides. Assign the event or memory to someone that's not you, if it happened to you, or to a character other than the one who had the experience in question. Those of you who've been through analysis, the issues of transference. In creative writing, we call it making stuff up. But I guess in some ways, because it's what's worked for me, the notion is let time pass. Let the truth settle and fade so that you can find the larger truth in what you're writing. Art, if that's what you're after, takes time. It's not a Wendy's burger. More importantly, it's about new combinations. But if you take a little of this and a little of that and shake it up and let it ferment, you'll be amazed at what you can create. Vulcanized rubber, a new concoction, an emulsification, or, God help us all, blue cheese dressing. Thank you. Might want to talk about this if anybody, we have, I think, a few moments, and we were advised to save some time for questions. So, please. I think that's true. I think you might want to record it, in a journal if you're trying to hold on to what happened, but then you have to let go because, trust me, or at least it's my experience, that if you're trying to get down exactly what happened, it's really hard to make it come back to life, for other people. It might be alive for you, but we're trying to take something here, put it here, so that it's here for someone else. Yeah?
How did you, in fact, transform that story about the stick up into something that was livelier?
I never did. It's yours if you want to use it. I have told it at many a cocktail party, but I've never been able to have it work in the.
I've been in some similar situations, but I always said, no, he's going to stick me up and walk
away. Right. That's right. Yeah. When using an actual memory, have I felt that I failed to actually convey the richness of what had happened because I couldn't quite get it all down?
Or because you needed, you found that because of the needs of your narrative, it went in a certain direction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I guess the answer for me would be no, that
partially because I don't mostly have written of things that took place a while before. They begin to merge for me. And I guess I'm at peace with the idea that my memories become my art. I mean, I've been doing it most of my life. So, yeah.
Is there any sort of intellectual honesty involved or dishonesty involved? Most of it had, normal lives.
Mm-hmm. It's a real problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Turn one of them into an axe burner or a pedophile, whatever you do. And so you say to yourself, am I serving art by taking basically something that is inspiring and warm and wonderful that maybe it's not going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to turn it into something bizarre and grotesque and that'll sell, that'll grip the reader more. And you say, well, if I were more talented, I might be able to make an interesting novel out of two loving parents, but probably not. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to have to make them grotesque, bizarre. I'm going to have to make up the kind of tension we didn't have. Now, do you feel that you've sort of abandoned? Is there something dishonest about that? I mean, it means the readers are constantly reading about people who are more grotesque
right.
than reality.
Right. And so, no, because I think that when I've had pretty extreme characters, there might be a point of connection, but neither of my parents was going to think, oh, that's me. So it's remarkable how often, in fact, people want to claim, are you writing about me when it's really not, and a pretty grotesque character. And don't really, but I did in something I had written, the father, for a whole range of thematic reasons, the father was dead, and the mother was very clearly my own mother. In fact, I used their names. And so my father, who, I've always let my parents read the stuff in manuscript. They were both English majors. They saw their hopes of, a high-earning professional dashed after they paid for college. So I figured at least I could let them read a manuscript. And so he said, wait a minute here. I'm dead in this. What's this about? And I said, well, Dad, it's like, A, you're remembered lovingly. That's good. And B, it's like always everybody's fantasy, to hear what people are saying about you after you're gone. You get to do it in advance. So, thank God for the work of imagination. Yeah. I tend to, my sort of genesis tends to be with character and imagining the circumstance or the squeeze, the pressurized situation in which they find themselves and watching how they respond to that. And that really comes out of, what I thought, my initial inspiration was Faulkner. He talked about, just writing down what his characters did, sort of seeing them. Yeah. In the novel manuscript that I've just finished, not what I was reading here, comes out of a family story, and I didn't talk about that one because it's a complicated thing, but basically one aunt and uncle had a wild daughter. She gave up. She had a baby. This is in the 60s, and her parents adopted that little boy as their own, as son, not the more standard, raising the child for her, but and at the moment that little branch of the family, when my uncle died, they broke, my aunt, they just kind of broke the family and they kind of dropped out. And so I had long thought I would use that story at some point, and in this novel, it's very much part of it. And that one, I'm a little nervous about. Because at age 12,
little Frankie, thought that still thought his grandparents were his parents, and I don't know. I'd imagined when I was a young writer that I would, set the novel when he was a teenager, when he was finding out. I don't know if he ever did, and so that when family members read that, I'm actually kind of nervous about what they will think. But as Tobias Wolfe, has written memoirs and said to their mother, if you don't like the version that I've written, write your own. And so that's yes.
Now that you've been published, do you find that family members or friends are intimidated then by not saying anything? Pat Conroy's mother, I read that she said she was dying. Uh-huh. And she said, I don't want you at my deathbed because I don't want you to write about my last words.
Right. No, that hasn't happened yet. And partially, but something I haven't talked about here, I before I was teaching, I wrote copiously for, I was the male voice in the female magazine universe. And so I've written endlessly nonfiction, directly from life about my children, how my son got his name. And so there was, if you're writing sort of narrative essays, and I'm teaching that this weekend, you are constantly writing from life and using it in a way. And my kids have kind of gotten used to it. My son was the first one when that novel that was sort of inspired by his life came out, to on the Amazon site. I am Eric Goodman's son. This novel is it's really me. Just in case the publisher who actually advertised it is saying inspired by hadn't made it clear, my son wanted to claim it. Yeah. I think that's a really great question, and I think that we could, maybe by a show of hands, talk about that. I also am a little bit superstitious. Certain things that are so, that are so powerful like that. Like I did not write down, what it felt like to be up in the air, thinking I'm going to die. I felt like I was suspended when I got knocked up by this huge limb. It was kind of horizontal like this. And, felt like time stopped and I was kind of hanging there, horizontal, 25 feet off the ground with a chainsaw in one hand, thinking. So I never committed a sentence of that to the page. I also kind of think it's in there. You're not going to, certain things are sort of like, now part of your being. But what about the rest of you? I mean, do you write down the question that, when you're transforming life into art or working from life experience, do you write it down and then look at what you've written down and to try to work it onto the page or not? So how many of you, would say you do it that way? You write it down and then try to use what you've recorded? Well, very small minority.
It depends on the event.
Uh-huh. The advice for people, is to, if you're a writer, to keep a journal, because you don't know what's going to be of use to you later. Certain sorts of details, are wonderful to have. Really powerful events, I think you're going to hold on to, though. Yes?
When I talk with people that have had shocking events happen in their life, I often relate that to the grieving process. Mm-hmm. This is too analytical, but bargaining, it's denial and mm-hmm. acceptance. And your comment there about, you know, it needs to age, you know, like wine, you know, the it's particularly shocking events. And I'm reminded sometimes of, there's a gal that I work with on poetry, and she very good writing skills, but she's so stuck on the Bush administration and writing angry poems that all that comes through is just the anger, you know. And I know in working with other people, I've said to them, you know, like, okay, they're on the anger stage. Then I try to go ahead and say, well, why don't you write about that? Why don't you just pour that out on a piece of paper? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, in a way, kind of the bargaining stage. You know, if you write about this, you will feel better.
Right.
And then also there's a lot of bargaining relative to God. God kind of plays a part in that bargaining stage. Mm-hmm. And then, of course,
he drives a hard bargain, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And then there's the denial stage. And that can be lying.
Mm-hmm.
It can be honest denial, in which it is so painful that you can't get in touch with it, and so your mind wants to block that out. But also then there's the comic stage, and many of the comedians take stories from their lives.
Right.
That are so painful, really, that they could do that. And then, of course, finally, then the acceptance stage.
Right. Certain things you never accept, and I think one of the great things about writing is that, you know, you can change the way things happen. You know, you can transform it in that way. I think we have one last question.
I was actually referring to the whole writing it down. I think some of it depends on what your memory is like. I tend to remember events very clearly and not really want to deal with the emotions of it. So kind of what she was saying with processing something from your own life, I find that the journals that I wrote at the time to process the emotions of a particular event turned out to be very helpful, because I could write from all of the this happened and this happened and this happened and be very dry and sterile. And so I went back and read what I wrote, and then I would be actually back in the moment that I couldn't really manufacture without having had that right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, again, thanks for coming out on this rainy day.
Thank you.